Hello, I'm Urmila Mohan, founder of the Jagad Project, an online platform for publishing and education on material culture and embodiment studies. I am speaking from New York.
Hi, my name is Emma Cieslik. I'm a museum professional and religious scholar based in Washington, D.C., and I'm the newest member of the Jagad Project team. We're here today to welcome you to the first episode of our new podcast, Embodied Worlds. This podcast is supported by the Jagad Project, an independent publication hosting workshops, articles, and interviews devoted to research at the intersection of religion, embodiment, and material culture. The idea to create a podcast first came to us earlier this year as an entry point into the stories featured in our articles, deeper dives into these topics, and one-on-one conversations with not only scholars, but also artists and craftspeople from around the world. Today, Urmila and I sat down with Jean-Pierre Varnier to discuss more about his material culture research and academic mentorship.
Based on the idea of what it is to practice something and what practice does to a person, one can look at an anthropologist's life biography in terms of their research projects, their programs, their paradigms and field settings. But one can also look at it in terms of all the encounters that the person has made all along and the relationships and experiences that have opened up new avenues for connection, exchange, and innovation. It is this relational aspect of practicing anthropology as well as conducting ethnography that is difficult to grasp. Situated somewhere between the acumen acquired by training, educational degrees, and belonging to professional groups, and the alchemy of being in a particular time, place, and circumstance. One can plan for this, but it is only in hindsight that the pieces of the puzzle seem to come together. To grasp one piece of that research puzzle today, we have the opportunity to hear from the French anthropologist and academic Professor Jean-Pierre Varnier, or JP as he is also known, who since 1971 has studied the Mankon Kingdom in West Cameroon, Africa. He is currently retired and living in France, but very much writing and publishing actively.
Hello, Mila and Emma. Thanks a lot for calling me to share around our common interest in body and material culture about the encounters I've made through my career.
JP, for those of us who are being introduced to you through this podcast, could you explain what your research has consisted of and how it has progressed over the years?
It started in the early 70s. I did research, as you said, on the Kingdom of Mankon in Cameroon. At first, I produced my PhD thesis, which was a monography of the kingdom, quite typical of what was expected in social anthropology at the time. Then in 1976, I was teaching in Nigeria, and I made the acquaintance of Michael Rowlands, who was teaching at UCL. He was looking for a fieldwork setting that was quite similar for what I was doing. We were introduced to each other by a common friend. We decided to do research together in Cameroon on material culture that was taught at UCL. There was a teaching program on local and regional hierarchies and exchange networks. The issues on material culture became more and more prominent in our work till in 1985, I was recruited as a professor at the University of Paris Descartes. At the time, ethnology was a legitimate topic in the universities in France, but definitely not material culture. It was not an accepted topic. A French archaeologist and anthropologist André Leroy-Gourhand had ruled out the expression of material culture on the grounds that it suggested a difference, a distinction between material culture and immaterial culture, between body and soul. It was, he claimed, a dualistic approach, and he didn't want to hear about material culture. Yet there was a need for studies in material culture because objects, the kind of day-to-day material world, of man-made material world, was not actually studied. So the question was how to deal with that particular topic. We founded a research group, and in around 1990, its name was coined by two colleagues, Marie-Pierre Julien and Céline Rosselin. They called it the group Matière à penser, that is, matter for thought.
So could you tell us some more about the Matière à penser group on embodiment, and what do you think is so significant about their research and their publications for not just French material culture studies, but I would think material culture studies for anybody who is interested in it?
We had a number of paradigms at hand regarding, say, mass consumption and objects. For example, from semiology, objects, insofar as they signified something, had a signed value in a system of communication and connotation. There was a French author, Jean Baudrillard, who was quite well known at the time, but we were dissatisfied with that, because what we had in mind was not the objects in terms of their signed value, but the dynamics of human beings in their man-made world. All the objects we live with on a day-to-day basis, all the appliances, the households, the furniture, and so on. We are interested by the objects on the move with human beings on the move. Because subjects have a body and they are a body. So the body and motricity became the center of our attention. That is the senses, the sensory motor conducts. We started reading Marcel Mauss, The Techniques of the Body. We read phenomenology, praxeology, that had been developed in France by Espinasse at the beginning of the 20th century. Then a colleague of us, Pierre Parlebas, especially around sports and playing. So the group was rather successful. At some point, there were about 10 to 20 people in it, and we shared a lot of fieldwork inquiries in France, but in various countries, including Cameroon. The publications included in 2004 Matière à politique, that is, matter for politics on bodies and things and power. And subsequently, in 2007, I published The Pot King, The Body and Technologies of Power, about the Kingdom of Von Korn. And from there on, say the early 2000s, we kept publishing very regularly on all kinds of topics.
So I heard you talk about the relevance of this approach, which we also refer to as MAP for short, the MAP approach for the study of politics, but we focus more on religion, spirituality, and belief. I wonder, how do we contextualize these ideas and make them applicable to religion? How do you think this approach can be applied?
Actually, there's no religious practice that does not aim to capture the subjectivities of followers, of devotees, through sensory motor cultures based on specific material cultures. I know of no exception. We fast, we feast, we consume psychotropic drugs, we sing, we play music with musical instruments, we walk on pilgrimage to shrines, we bow, we touch statues and images, we stone state of Satan, ingest water or letters of the Quran that have been washed with water. All those practices really belong to the core of religion. Religion is not only a question of discourse, of creeds, of words. It's also a question of the body doing the many, many things that are requested or required by devotional practices. Sensory motor praxeology and the study of material culture in bodily conduct therefore offers a privileged tool for studying religious facts and its connection to politics. One of the limitations of studies on religious facts is that by focusing on representations, symbols, beliefs, and everything that happens in the head or in verbalizations, we struggle to produce an ethnography of practice and to account for the mechanism of ascent, the impact of practice on subjectivities. The devotee cannot feel a sense of devotion only by words. The devotee has to do things and to move with one's body, and the devotee has to feel things with the senses. And religious anthropology, by and large, takes only into account one half of the brain, that is verbalized knowledge. The other half of the brain, that is poorly verbalized and pre-conscious procedural knowledge, bodily knowledge, is just as important. We have to take into consideration the two sides of it. And the praxeological paradigm asks theoretical questions about the relationship between body and language, procedural knowledge and verbalized knowledge, which are of the greatest interest, to the extent that we cannot postulate neither independence nor perfect superposition between these two types of knowledge. There are discrepancies and contradictions between the two, and they are a mine to explore, which opens up incredible perspectives on religious practice and devotion.
Thank you, JP. You also pointed out that these two registers of verbalized knowledge and procedural knowledge, they relate to each other, but there's also a gap between them. And here at the Jagat Project platform, we don't seek to elevate one over the other, but we hope to continue this vein of inquiry where we look at the relationship between these two things, because we know that the people we interview in these communities do have ideas of their own. They do verbalize them. They do talk about them. They also have practices. And so this brings it down to the idea of the ethnographer and the way ethnography now is used as a methodological tool by people in so many different disciplines. Our listeners could be from various professions. And for those of those people who want to understand ethnography better, especially from somebody like you who has engaged in that practice for your work, what is it to be an anthropologist embedded in ethnographic and other experiences, but also when the anthropologist is also shaped and shaping those relationships? So this idea of subjectivation applies to the ethnographer. In this context, what is the idea of the field for you, and how has associated concepts of landscape and terrain been relevant to your work? You remind us in one of your publications that the map is not the terrain.
As Magritte said and painted, the picture of the pipe is not the pipe. So we cannot do away with field work and go to the terrain and do inquiries in the real world. I never ceased to return to Cameroon till 2009. I needed to see and touch and experience, and I was always surprised by new things I could see and new people I met in the field. It was a constant challenge, and we must be careful not to become a library or armchair anthropologist. In all kinds of research, we've got to go back and experience. For one thing, societies are not static. They are immersed in history. They change. And something we may not see at one point, we may see it a year later, a couple of years later. Think of what has happened with the COVID crisis, entirely new things were created and experienced.
So your own work on bodily and material practices forms the basis for our platform. And I want to think further about what it is to be subjectivated and shaped as an anthropologist, ethnographer, and academic. I want to bring up your 2005 essay in French, whose title in English means The Condition of the Ethnologist in an African Hierarchy, Dancer or Grasshopper? That's the question that's posed. How did writing this encourage you to reflect upon things?
It occurred to me that when a researcher is asked to account for his or her research, one of the ways to do it is to comment on, as you said, the conceptual design of research projects, the paradigms of the setting of the intended setting of the field research. And at the beginning of my research, when I started writing a monography of the kingdom, I was pretty much in that perspective. But another way to do, to account for one's research, is to construct a narrative of encounters. I went to the University of Pennsylvania for my graduate studies, and there I was asked to choose an area, a culture area for my research, and I chose Africa. They said, okay, if you want to go to Africa, then Igor Kopitov will be your supervisor. So I met Igor Kopitov, and he told me to go to Cameroon because there was one king who was requesting the presence of a PhD student to study his kingdom. So Kopitov sent me to Hong Kong, where I met with the king, and I learned that actually Kopitov had known that king through Sally Chilver, who was a British academic and researcher who met the king of Hong Kong in 1959. And at that point, the king of Hong Kong asked Sally Chilver to send someone, but she did not have anyone at hand. So she forwarded the request to Igor Kopitov. So I'm already speaking with three people, Igor Kopitov, Salichenko, the King of Moncloa. But subsequently, I met many, many more people in Moncorn, first of all, and then Mike Rowlands, then Jean-François Bayard, 1983. Then when I started teaching at the University of Yaoundé, I met with my students, Cameroonian students, and I'm sure I learned far more from them than they learned from me. I met with Dieudonné Miafo, Séverin Béga, Francis Nyamjo, who is now a professor of anthropology at the University of Cape Town. I can actually describe my research trajectory through the encounters I made, and each and every one of those encounters changed my view of things, change my connection, my contacts change the questions I was interested in, change the access I had to the information. So I was shaped by those persons.
It's interesting you said that you were shaped by these encounters, and we see those ideas also reflecting. And of course, as you mentioned, Francis Beng-Namjo, whose work on incompleteness is also something that I discovered a few years ago. Could you comment a little bit about this idea of incompleteness and how it might be a philosophical as well as ethnographic prompt for us when we do our work?
The notion of incompleteness was coined by a Nigerian author, Amos Tutuola, and it struck Francis Nyamjo that it put words on an experience he had done since his childhood. The fact that none of us is self-made, but we parts of us can be brought and piled up or connected to ourselves in many, many different ways. And one has to look at human beings, at subject, not as complete and self-contained persons, but people open to the world and who need the world to peek into the world, everything that's going to constitute its own life and its own world. I was quite impressed by Francis Beng-Namjo wrote about incompleteness from Amos Tutuola, and how he gave a narrative of his own life, and it fits very well with the notion of subjectivation and the subject that has been developed by people like Michel Foucault, Slavoj Žižek, Michel de Certeau, and many others. The fact that it's more to the point to speak of human beings in terms of subject than individuals. The individual is defined by his freedom. The fact that the individual is designed to make choices and to manage oneself. It's all centered on the person, as if the person was a lone individual in the world, and that is not the case. Every subject is subjected to others, but at the same time governs oneself in relation to other people. And I think that if we want to go ahead on the and devise some kind of universalistic thought on a world scale, on a global scale, we should distance ourselves from the ideology of the self-contained individual.
You've given a lot of insight into this very complex and important topic of building relationships. And yes, power and acumen in the field, part of it is being incorporated into the field. And as you pointed out, you were useful also, as well as what it is to reflect back on a lifetime of anthropological work. That is no mean feat. But you have provided us something valuable to reflect upon. Professor Jean-Pierre Varnier, it's been wonderful talking to you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Romila. My pleasure.
Thank you for tuning in today to our first episode. Our second episode is going to feature Lily Hope, a Tlingit artist born and raised in Juneau, Alaska. We will be discussing the power and beauty of learning and preserving Chilkat weaving. Stay tuned.